ever call me on an open line, do not ever send me anything in writing that you don't wrap with aluminum foil when you put it in the envelope. I said, Roger, why? And he says, because this place is full of spies. The national labs are full of spies. He says, anything you send to me has to be handled this way. Anyway, he said, Dave, I'll do this for you. And so we wrote it all up. All we need him to do is take yellow gold and, following our procedures and our patent, make the white powder of gold from the yellow gold. And anyway, he said, Dave, we can do that. Well, he went to his a committee to approve okay for doing this. And the committee said, no, we won't let you do it. Argonne National Laboratory can only do procedures that cannot be done in private facilities. And this is just chemistry. You can do this in any facility. I said, but this just doesn't work. I need you to witness or oversee it. It needs to be done under your supervision. He said, well, Dave, I can't do it as Argonne National Laboratories. But he said, I'll tell you what I can do. Is there are people that working here in the Chicago area that has their own private lab that used to work for me here. And I'm personal friends. I go fishing with them and hiking with them every couple of weekends. We take off and go together. I know them personally. I'll contact them, have them do it for you. They'll write the affidavit and sign it for you. He's a PhD also. And then that'll be your verification for the patent office. So anyway, I contact him by telephone. Never went back to his lab. Never seen his lab. But I gave him the procedure over the U.S. mail, and they ran the procedure. They bought their own gold, spectroscopically pure gold, ran it through the procedure, produced the white powder of gold for us, and wrote us the affidavits for the patent office. And I was saying, and what this said, it says, we don't know what has been done here, but we purchased pure metallic gold, and we went through the chemical procedures using spectroscopically pure reagent-grade materials. And what we got at the end was a white powder. It does not analyze to be gold, but we have no explanation for where it came from or what it is other than it is gold. All our observations and understanding says that this material coincides with Mr. Hudson's description of the white powder gold or the Orange State gold. So anyway, here we get this affidavit, take it back to Pat Mamas. They sent it to the Department of Defense. Department of Defense says, now we want you to take the white powder gold and make it back to metallic gold. We want you to take the carbon and make it back to diamond. You took the diamond and tore it apart and made it into carbon. Now we want you to take the carbon and make it back into diamond. Well, by then I knew how to do it. But it took me about 3 years to learn how to do it. And I said, there's about 9,000 companies in the U.S. that would like to have this information. And you want me to tell you how to do it. And I don't think you need to know how to do it to know that the white powder of gold exists. My attorney said, Dave, it's going to cost you another about $1 million to $1,100,000 to pursue this at the patent office. To go through all these hoops they're putting before you. It already cost me about $80,000 to get the white powder gold produced. Now they want me to make the yellow metal out of the white powder gold. And I said, well, agriculture's in the dumper right now. We're not losing money all that fast. I'm only paying about $600,000 a year in interest to my banker. $600,000 a year to my banker. Fortunately, I was the largest farmer in Arizona, so it was not totally busting me, but every bit of my profit is going to pay the bank now. Agriculture wasn't doing very well in the 80s, and so I said, look, what if I give up my patent? What if I just walk away from this? And they said, Dave, the only way that you can walk away from this is they never can grant this patent to anybody else because you've applied for it. The only argument they ever could have is if, in fact, they could argue that you didn't tell the public about it. The public really didn't know about it. You just applied for patents. They said, to protect yourself, one thing you need to do is go out and talk to the general public and have them videotape it. So you see, there was a method to my madness in 1995 when I came down here and talked with Cheyenne. It was to get it on videotape. And that's why I'm doing it tonight. But I'll tell you, after I spoke on this, I was really surprised how many people truly understood what I was talking about. They were really interested in what I was talking about. They were really intrigued by what I was talking about. And so after I talked down here with Cheyenne, I actually talked for another 8 months, and I began to offer memberships in the Science of the Spirit Foundation for $500 each. During those 8 months, I raised over $2 million to build the pilot production facility. I actually spoke to over 3,500 people one night with Jay-Z Knight up in Ramtha Group up in Washington. There was 3,500 people in the audience. There were so many people who had the video cameras and then screens set up so the people could see me because they were so far away they couldn't see me on the podium talking to them. Anyway, they all brought their sleeping bags, and I started speaking at 9 in the morning, and 8 o'clock at night, and I spoke till 3:30 in the morning, and we still were talking, and I just said, I got to go. I got to get out of plane at 6 o'clock in the morning and go back to Phoenix. And I said, it's 3:30 already. I got to get some sleep. So I finally quit at 3:30. I think we need to take a short break here, let everybody stretch their legs, do whatever they got to do, see the little boys and girls rooms or whatever, and then we'll come back. Let's make the short break about 10 minutes long, and when you come back, we'll start a video overhead projection presentation of the philosophical aspects of this. Okay? I'm glad most of you stayed. You haven't gotten bored with this far. I'm sorry for the long-windedness, but I'm trying to answer what questions people have called and asked me. They said, when you made your presentation, you didn't say this, you didn't say this. And you wouldn't believe the questions and the things they wanted to know, which to me had nothing to do with the story, but they wanted it stuck in. So now I'm trying to include it in this tape so that there won't be questions afterwards. What I want people to understand is that in 1991, 92, I made the decision that I would not pursue these patents anymore because of the problems I was having with the Department of Defense and the patenting here in the United States. So I never went from patent applied for to patent pending in the United States. Also, Great Britain, Canada, there's several countries that depend on the U.S. to make a decision before they make the decision. They always follow suit. And I never went to patent pending in those countries. I actually dropped the patents and didn't pursue them anymore after 1991. So by 1992, they basically had lapsed. Anyway, there's some confusion about that. I filed U.S. and Worldwide patents on ORMs. There was actually, eight elements, the ORM state, and then eight systems of the ORMs as a mini-atom system, a superconducting state. Anyway, I withdrew the patents. They're not active anymore, but I have spoken publicly about this. After I spoke down here with Cheyenne, I spoke about 8 months longer. I raised $2 million. I built the facility, and I brought slides here that I would like to show people just so they can see what it looks like. If you can put these two up. This is my bathtub, a backyard operation. Up here on the left is the office and vacuum furnace building in the foreground, and the chemistry building is back here in the background. These are all steel buildings. There's two buildings here. There's a crushing building and a melting building. These are two buildings side by side, different buildings. This is the melting furnace, which is an atmosphere-controlled melting furnace, and here's the jaw crusher and the micro-pulverizing equipment and all we use to pulverize the natural source. And if you show us the next slide. This doesn't give you an idea of the scale, but these are 2,000-gallon fodder reactors, which are like glass-lined pressure cookers. Okay? They weigh about, this one weighs about 24,000 pounds each. They are extremely heavy. We dropped one on the reinforced concrete floor and made an impression in the floor about 2.5 inches deep when it hit the concrete. Only dropped from about 2 feet, so it's very, very heavy, people. Anyway, these are glass-lined pressure cookers, and these are stainless steel lined tanks. These are the chemical tanks outside the facility, are all lined. This is a glass-lined tank.
And then there's two vertical tanks. There are 33,000-gallon tanks that are glass-lined back here behind. You can't see those. This is a stainless steel purified water tank. This is the vacuum furnace. These are 7.5-inch tubes, quartz tubes, and these are vacuum pumps that sit back behind it. And they're connected, one vacuum pump to each of the tubes, so you can pull a vacuum on each tube. And there's four of these pumps sitting back here in the back. And you just flip a switch, and within about 5 seconds, everything's gone out of that tube. It really pulls the vacuum down very, very fast. And here's another shot up here of the vacuum furnace, looking at it from the end. It's all computer control, electronics on it. It was custom made for IBM. They paid $1.8 million for the furnace. I can't pay that much money, but they only used it about a month and a half. Then they gave it away when they sold the business to another company. The other company didn't need the furnace, so they gave it to the University of Arizona. The University of Arizona gave it to a contractor doing work for him as part payment for his work, and I bought it from the contractor. Anyway, I didn't pay anywhere near that much money for it. But it's quite a furnace, and it comes in sections. And this is my son standing back here working on the computer controls. Anyway, this gives you a rough idea of the kind of equipment that we're working with. It's very expensive and very complex equipment. All the piping in here is all Teflon line. The piping goes together with flange joints. All the valves are Teflon valves. It is quite sophisticated chemistry. Anyway, it gives you a feeling for what was involved and what we're doing. One of the questions that arose when we found out that these elements are like stealth atoms, and I use that because most people are familiar with the stealth aircraft. You know, you look up in the sky, and here comes the stealth airplane overhead, and it's there. You see it, but the radar says there's nothing there. And, you know, I ask you, are you going to believe the radar? Are you going to believe your eyes? If you look up the sky and see a stealth plane, there's a plane there. Now, if that radar doesn't see it, the problem is with the radar. My eyes are not fooling me if I see that plane up there. Well, these elements exist in a state that no machine can see them. But they're there, and they do everything they're supposed to do, then why aren't they as valuable as the metal is? So I got so frustrated trying to quantitatively make it into metal, I said, well, baloney, I'm just going to forget that. For right now, I'm going to work on the elements. What is the element, and what value does it have? What properties does it have? What will it do as the element material? I know if I mount it with carbon and you put an electropotential, that it acts just like the metal. It works just as a catalyst in fuel cell production. However, when you turn the current up on the fuel cell, it gets up about exactly the same as the metal does up to a point. When the current density gets to about half of what it is with the metal, our material quits working. It just goes flat. Where the metal continues to go on up, you can go to higher current densities. So there was a difference between the monatomic material and the metal. If you want the same current out of our material, you have to use about twice as much of the element as you're using metal to get the same power out of it, because the current density isn't as great if you use the same amount. There are some other differences we're finding. But I also wanted to understand exactly what the material was, and so I did a whole bunch of weight studies and all, which I'm going to present in my presentation tomorrow. Tomorrow is going to be the science part of it. Okay? The balance of the presentation tonight is going to be on this stealth material and what is it. I became very intrigued with where else might we find this material. If it's in nature, in natural rocks and soils, then it's in the plants. But if it's in the plants, it's probably in animals. If it's in the animals, it's probably in humans. You know, so let's take samples of plant tissues and animal tissues and let's analyze them and do quantitative studies and find out how much of these elements are in what materials. So we have right here a list of some things that a fellow worker with me prepared, and I showed this down in my Tampa presentation. These are some things that we did analysis on. The calf and pig brains. Now, what we did is we just went to the supermarket. We said, you got some calf's brains? And they gave us some calf's brains. We cut off part of the calf's brains. We weighed it, and we put it in a beaker, and we destroyed the calf's brains by fuming it with sulfuric acid. It carburized all the calf brains, and then we oxidized it all the way to nitric acid, and then and I can't tell you the specific chemistries tonight, but we did the quantitative separations of rhodium and iridium, And there was an excess of 2.5%. 2.5% of the cow's brains and pig's brains and are rhodium and iridium, just these two elements. Now, I don't know how many of you people understand, but if you go to some doctor and ask him or somebody who's in medical research and say, how much of all the metals are in brain tissue? They won't come up with these numbers of all other metals that are supposedly in the brain. Okay? But these materials are there, just no machine knows they're there. But I can physically separate them out and hand them to you, and they have the properties of rhodium and iridium, and they are rhodium and iridium, if you know how to spec them. Anyway, then we took a bunch of materials here that are basically associated with medicinal properties, natural products, herbs, natural products, and we analyzed them. Grape juice, this was Seneca frozen, diluted 1:3, and took 4 ounces of it, analyzed it, has 158 milligrams of rhodium, 239 milligrams of iridium, for a total of 397 milligrams of the both. Carrot juice, which is a lot of people claim has anti-cancer properties, if you use high amounts of it, we found in 4 ounces it has 139 milligrams of rhodium, 184 milligrams of iridium. Now, I want to say right here, people, that I took carrot juice that was produced back in Iowa and analyzed it, and it had no rhodium or iridium in it. So it isn't just that it's a carrot, it's where it's raised, what soil and what water is available to the carrot. So, you know, I'm just saying this is a carrot that I analyzed that was grown in Arizona, and this is the analysis we got of it. Orco-Nigel maritime pine bark, which is called, Finogival? It's a ginkgo extract, 3 tablets, 3.4 grams, with 105 milligrams of rhodium and 70 milligrams of iridium. R pure aloe, which is a commercial product, and I'm not endorsing this product just because I'm using it on my list. It's just one we had available to us, which they claim is mucopolysaccharides. Anyway, we did 1 ounce of it with 60 milligrams of rhodium, 10 milligrams of iridium. A product called Ultimate Aloe, we took 1 ounce of it, and it had 48 milligrams of rhodium. We could not detect iridium in it. The Ultimate Aloe Flash Dried, 1 gram of it, was 22 milligrams. And a product called Man Aloe, which was freeze-dried aloe, which I believe is made with a company here in Dallas area. Anyway, Man Aloe, it had 2 capsules, or 1 gram, had 21 milligrams of rhodium in it. A product made by Imprise Plus, which is Mexican wild yam, Dioscorea plus Man Aloe, 3 tablets, 3.5 grams, had 17 milligrams of rhodium in it. And I can't tell you why, you know, this happens, why the changes. Vitality, which is a product that is available in Phoenix, with 6 herbs, it's basically the same thing as Essiac. If people are familiar with Essiac tea. Anyway, 2 ounces, 17 milligrams, 53 milligrams of iridium. The thing that's great about Essiac tea is it's in a hydroxide form. And the hydroxide form has, the organic material is not that great in it, so it basically goes to a chloride very rapidly in the stomach, and as a chloride, it's absorbed through the gut and in the bloodstream. Blood root, 1 gram, 6 milligrams, 22. Anyway, here they all are, Essiac tea. There was only 6 milligrams of rhodium, 6 milligrams of iridium. Ace Manin, and I come to this one and brought attention to it because Ace Manin is a product that people were confusing with Man Aloe. And they're not to be confused. Ace Manin is made by Carrington Laboratories. They trade on the New York Stock Exchange. Ace Manin is cleared by the FDA as a cancer treatment in animals. It's not cleared for human use. But Ace Manin is important because Ace Manin is they've taken the aspect of the aloe that has the anti-cancer properties, and they've extracted just that part of it from the aloe vera, and they produce it as a medicinal property. And that material is over 92%. It's 9 milligrams out of 10 milligram sample. 9 milligrams is rhodium. Now, that's really significant, people. If you're familiar with that product or seen that product used, that product is virtually pure rhodium. And they tell you, if you talk to the company that makes it, that that is pure mucopolysaccharide. And people, mucopolysaccharide is like a sugar. It's hydrogen, carbon, oxygen, but there's no metals in it. And if you take this product right here and put it into sulfuric acid, fume it, and destroy all the organics, so it becomes black carbon, oxidize it away 2 or 3 times with nitric acid, boiling it down with sulfuric acid until all your carbon is oxidized to carbon dioxide, there should be nothing left in the beaker. Everything's gone. Everything's water or gone. And yet you evaporate down to a minimum of solution and bring it up with water, and all this voluminous hydroxide precipitates out of solution. Looks like iron. Well, my question is, what in the world is in mucopolysaccharide that makes that precipitate? It's very simple, people. There's something else there. Anyway, I'm telling you this rhodium is what's there. But anyway, this is most people find this very interesting, you know, informative. It's just a hodgepodge of elements we grab bagged. I'm not trying to endorse or push a product. I'm just telling you what's there. And I think that when you realize that these elements are associated with certain plants, they are taken up in high quantities by certain plants, and those plants are normally associated with having medicinal properties. Okay. Now, one of the things that really intrigued me is this material is everywhere, and I came to the conclusion that it's not rare that the platinum group elements are considered precious elements. They're considered to be rare metals. But when you understand that carbon and diamond are the same atoms, carbon is very rare because it's carbon that's been crystallized under high energy and pressure. But every atom in that diamond and every atom in that black city carbon are the exact same atoms. And it's hard to look at that diamond, look at that black city carbon and say that it's exactly the same stuff. Every atom in each is the same. But when you envision how fine must I divide that diamond before it becomes carbon, and you get to get an appreciation for the work I'm doing. How many times must I cut that diamond up before I get carbon? Well, I was finding that diamonds are rare, carbon's everywhere. The precious metals are rare, but the elements are everywhere. They aren't nearly as rare as we're being told. Okay? Precious metals are very valuable. For example, the gentleman doing the filming here has asked me if I would comment on how valuable they are. At a time, rhodium was selling for over $3,000 an ounce because rhodium has to be used in your catalytic converters or your automobiles. Now, the published price on it, I think, is like $400 or $500 an ounce is the metal price. But fuel cell grade rhodium is about $1,200, $1,500 when the market's only $300 or $400 for metals. Because fuel cell grade is pure, higher purity, and specific quality of material. But every automobile manufacturer has to have at least 12% rhodium in the catalytic converter. If he doesn't have it, he can't build a car. So when they were having problems down in South Africa, it looked like the rhodium may not be available from South Africa. The price went to over $3,000 an ounce. Okay. Iridium is used in the nose cone of the reentry vehicles. It's used in aircraft spark plugs on gasoline motors. It's used for the contacts on nuclear power plants and hydroelectric plants where they have to pull the breakers apart and recontact. Those contacts are made out of iridium because iridium, you can burn an arc on it all day long and never phase the metal. It's a metal-type glass. It's very, very resistant to corrosion. Anyway, I said, if these elements are this plentiful and people have been working around here in chemistry for thousands of years, somebody, somewhere, has to run into these elements. I can't be the only stupid guy that runs into it. There's got to be other people that have encountered this stuff in the past. Somewhere in the literature, so I start back, you know, 1940s, 1930s, 1920s, 1900s, you know, going back and reading all this information about precious elements. I find some real neat things written because they wrote very practically back before the turn of the century. Anyway, my secretary went to a psychic and had a reading by the psychic. And the psychic told her all these things about this man she was going to meet and how what jewelry he's going to be wearing and what he's going to look like. And he was going to ask her out. You're going to become intimately involved with him. And anyway, within 2 days, my secretary goes to this new doctor, and this doctor is exactly the way the psychic described him, wearing the very same jewelry the psychic told her he's going to be wearing. And he invited her out after going to him one time for a doctor's visit. So she comes to me and she said, Dave, I want you to go to this psychic. Her name's Jan Ross. I want you to go see this Jan Ross and see what Jan Ross tells you. You know, because if with what you're doing, she's got to pick up on this and she's got to be interested in it, and she'll bring it up if you go to her. And I really like Dana. Dana Schilling was her name, the secretary. And I said, Dana, I'll go to her for you, but only just because it was Dana. She wanted me to go, so I said, all right, I'll go. I'm not really into psychics and reveal or channel information. I mean, it's all well and good, but I can't explain it, and it's not science, so I won't get into it. So, but I said, I'll humor her. I'll go see this lady. When I got there, I walked in, and she says, who are you? I said, I'm David Hudson. No, you're not. I said, boy, this is some psychic. She says, I know Dave Hudson. He's my client. He's been waiting for years. You're not Dave Hudson. I said, no, I'm Dave Hudson. She said, well, you're really Dave Hudson? Show me your driver's license. I took my driver's license out and showed it to her. She says, well, I guess you're Dave Hudson. You're just not the Dave Hudson I thought was coming. She said, he's an old friend of mine. He's a hairdresser. And I said, well, I'm not a hairdresser. I'm a farmer. Oh, I'm sorry. I made a mistake. Anyway, she said, I'll get dressed. So she goes in and gets her house coat off and puts her clothes on, comes in. We sit down at her kitchen table. I mean, this is going to be good. You know, she doesn't even know who I am. You know, she's going to tell me things about myself and she doesn't know who I am. It took about 10 minutes, but when she picked up on this, it's really astounding. She told me all the people involved in the work I was doing. She said, you're trying to prove a concept to science that isn't understood. She says, you're working with people. She named the people at GE. She named John Sicafu. She named Al. She named my attorney. She was going to help me. She named everybody. And I'm sitting there, you know, dumbfounded. Man, this is incredible. I'm looking for Candid Camera. You know, it's got to be a catch this. There's somebody playing in this thing. But she was telling me things that even my secretary didn't know. You know, you get goosebumps listening to this lady, you know. And I'm, wow, this is getting strange. So anyway, she has a bookstore. She calls Jan Ross Gifts and Books. I go to her bookstore, and she has all these books in there. And I begin to research on it, and I find out that other people have found white powder gold. And there's lots of books written about the white powder gold. And I said, wait a minute, can there be two white powders of gold? I can't believe there's one white powder of gold. I've got the white powder gold, and I can't believe it's white powder, and now I find out that the white powder gold was written about in the ancient texts. Anyway, I brought some slides here. We're going to go through some of them. Let's go with the first slide here. All right, this is the introduction to, let's see, what is this? And this is, I believe, is called Lapidus. Anyway, it says, if asked what is alchemy, the short answer might be the search for the philosopher's stone. This, however, is no stone, but a powder with the power to transmute base metals into gold or silver. Thousands of books have been written on the subject throughout the centuries in many languages in many parts of the world. It may be possible conjecture that this is how the unfortunate Incas of Peru produced such great quantities of gold, or again it can be hazarded that from the same source came the gold from which King Solomon decorated his temple so lavishly in biblical times. The philosopher's stone was also called the elixir of life, which has the virtue of being able to cure any of the diseases of mankind, thus assuring perfect health and longevity far beyond the normal lifespan that is hoped for by man. Now, you know, you just read this amount. You say, gosh, this is really some nifty stuff, huh? And this is called the white powder of gold, the philosopher's stone. Anyway, the stone, you know, I said, well, let's find out more about it. So, you know, it's called the elixir, and they got into Saint Germain and all sorts of other stuff they talked about, which I wasn't really, you know, wanting to get involved in. So I said, well, let's go a little further. So let's put the next slide on. Okay, let's down here at the bottom, and I'm sorry, this pointer that she gave me 4 years ago is wearing out. The battery is going bad on it, I think. Anyway, we're going to start right here. This actually is a book about the search for the Ark of the Covenant, and it was talking about the Ark of the Covenant, where it was, and.